accession number 19766, reel 8.
Reel 8.
They took him back to their lines, and I never saw him after that. But I was on my own now, and I did realize what it must have been like when we'd heard in films and that sort of thing about no man's land, because I was in no man's land. There was nobody else around. They'd all gone on. They were up there among the trees by now in the jungle. And I staggered on and probably fell over once or twice on the lumps of stone-hard clay. I remember before all this happening, before this chap had got wounded, we were walking along, and a chap, and every time the guns boomed, we used to duck down behind a bund, and there was a chap coming up just over there, so to speak, a few yards on my right, and he would never come down behind a bund, and I said to him, "Why the blazes you didn't come on down?" "Oh," he said, "they'd never hurt me." Just carried on walking. Now, whether he was around the bend or not, I wouldn't know, but that's what he said. "They never hurt, or they never seemed to hurt me," and just carried on walking. I never knew what happened to him. In the end, I don't know, really. But anyway, I eventually got up to quite close to the jungle, the trees and the jungle, and I jumped into a shell hole. And on the other side of the shell hole were two, what I thought were Japanese, because they looked just like Japs to me. And they had woolly caps on. The woolly, we had a name for them, I forgot what to call them now. We all had a little scarf, which you turned up and made a cap of. Unfortunately, they both grinned, and they were Gurkhas. But I thought they were Japs first, because I threw my Tommy gun forward, and they looked at me and laughed. So that was all right. So I eventually found my battalion and found my own chaps in the jungle, in various parts of the jungle. Now, various things happened in there. Of course, some of the shells landed in the trees. I never heard of anybody being damaged by shell fire from our side. But various branches used to be shot down. And on one occasion, I know one lot came down very close to me, a shower of treetop sort of came down on us. Didn't hurt anybody, fortunately, but we all, those who were underneath it, remarked about it in no uncertain language, you know, as you can imagine. But, and all this was going on, there was fighting going on over there, there were shots being fired there was boom bangs all over the place, and we were advancing all the time until we got to the other side of the wood, and we'd won that battle. Or pots and pans. I don't know what the death rate was, but it is quite high, I believe. Not so much on our side, but certainly on theirs. But that was a dry one, that, fortunately. But I think after that, what happened after that? We were getting close now to coming out because I think probably we were the long... I think we might have been longer in action than any troops probably in the war. We'd been in for 10 months without a break. That's an awful long time. And we came out in June, I think it was, having gone in about October time, something like that, previous October. We were in for 10 months anyway. That's an awful long time, that. And then we were transported back to India, to Ranchi.
Were you given leave?
Oh, yes, very much so. We had a notice round that we could go anywhere in India. Anywhere we chose to go in India, you got a month's leave. And I remember I had half a dozen acquaintances, because they weren't particular pals of mine. They were pals among themselves. I had friends. They were friends of mine, but in the sense that they were over there, and I was here, that sort of thing. And I remember looking at a map of India and looking at Kashmir. And it was as far as you could go in India. So I looked around for somebody who was prepared to go to Kashmir, and five other chaps, was there, or six? I can't remember now. five or six chaps. I'd like to go there. Right. So I went and asked the colonel if it was possible for us to go as far as Kashmir. He said, you can go where you like. So I booked for the number of us, whatever, five or six of us, booked whatever it was for a boathouse on the Dal Lake in Kashmir. And we got a reply, receipt for our money, whatever it was, I can't remember what it was. And away we went. It took us about a week to get there. But by golly, what a beautiful place. And we were up there for 3 weeks on Dal Lake. Beautiful. And we the most beautiful food you could think of. English cooking. They used to be proud of their English cooking. Because all the Saabs and Mem Saabs of pre-war days used to go to Kashmir. And they brought their skills with them. And they learned about cooking and all that sort of thing. There was a small houseboat behind our houseboat where the servants, because they were servants, lived. There was the chap who scrubbed and washed and swept the deck. There was the cook. And there was about three of them, I think, and probably their wives. And they were on a little flat boat behind our boat. And that's where they lived. And they used to come on to us when it was eating time. We'd sit around our table and they'd bring in the meals. Oh, gosh, they were marvelous cooks. Beautiful plates. I remember a plate full of potatoes. You'd think they'd come through a mesh. So they were all the same size, if you know what I mean. And they were all sprinkled with mint. Everywhere is as if they'd been through a mint shredder. Beautiful. And then egg custard and things of that sort. Marvellous food. Of course, to us, it was out of this world. So we used to dive off the end of the boat and swim in the Dal Lake, and we'd hire what they called a shikari, which was a small boat with an awning, and they'd paddle along. We lived like lords up there for a while. We used to get the local tradespeople come to the boat. Some would come with a boat full of flowers, buy flowers, ornaments. I've got a table lamp in there, which I bought up there, called a jungle. That was the name of it. I bought various things and sent them home. Sent my mother home a fur cape with a little hat and gloves to match. Himalayan Golden Fox, that's what it was called, Himalayan Golden Fox. Now, for 10 months in Burma, I come out with 80 pounds. 80 pounds for 10 months of murder, really. It was terrible times, really. So that wasn't an awful lot of money, was it, for that length of time? As a lance corporal. And then we come back to Ranchi, more drills, more training, reinforcements from Britain, from somewhere or another, make up the numbers, and onto the lorries and back in again for the 1945 campaign. So I was in three campaigns, and that one lasted long enough too, and right until the end of the war, right until it finished.
Was it much different from the other campaign?
It was drier. In the main, it was drier. It was flatter. The Cuds that we'd left behind, because they were, that part of Burma wasn't where the Himalayas hadn't extended that far. But it was quite interesting getting into the, getting from where we were. It was a terribly long drive, of course, a long, long way from Ranchi. We were in these garries. I remember coming through what they call Death Valley. What do they call that now? And ahead of us, there must have been a troop of soldiers plus tree fellas. We used to cut the teak trees down, but there were stumps this high. There were stumps that high, and the lorries used to be bumpity bumpity, and we'd be in the back going up and down, not a day after day, but week after week we'd be doing this. And dust dust. You never saw such dust because the crunching of the ground made it like as fine powder, you know. You'd be smothered in dust. We were given masks to wear. I had my watch covered up with a bandage and that sort of thing. Yeah, it was terrible going, really. And I remember one day we pulled up someplace, I'm forgetting the names. And there was a river there, and we stripped off and we got into this river, and 5 minutes after we got in, a lorry turned up, and two or three women got out of it. And they were the equivalent to, oh dear, what were the English people called who run canteens?
The British. Women's Royal Voluntary Service.
Yeah, that sort of thing. That sort
WVS.
Of thing. And they had cornflakes. I remember cornflakes in particular. They had boxes of cornflakes to sell, which was, well, I don't know whether they gave them to us or whether we had to buy them. I think we bought them actually. It wasn't very much, of course. But
these were WASBs, were they?
Something like that. Yes, something like that. And we wonder, how the heck did they get in here? I mean, for people like that to get in there after what we'd been through to get there, you know, they were tough old birds, they had to be. But they weren't old, they were youngish, from what I can remember. I never saw them after that, but they must have continued on with some part of the army. But, and then eventually we got to where... To a major General Slim had certain things built to cross the river, pontoons and such like, to cross the Irrawaddy. He was a marvellous man. He was the finest general of them all. I don't care what anybody says. I mean, to do what he did with nothing, no, very bad food, very little ammunition, very handful of aeroplanes. Everything had to be built and made. Ships, boats, and had to be, because they were all sunk. They had to be made, and we crossed the Irrawaddy, expecting any minute to be a dive bombed by somebody or other. But it didn't happen, not in our case anyway. And crossed the Irrawaddy to the other side, to Pococu, near Prome, which is famous for its temples. We were the division which crossed in secrecy. The 17th Indian did. They crossed in secrecy below Mandalay. Now, when all the battles were going on in Mandalay, we were crossing down below them. It was called the Hammer and Anvil Plan. The Hammer and the Anvil. And we once we crossed the river, we had a few skirmishes, but we didn't have any losses. We had a few skirmishes, and then we got on to... I remember singing, going across the Irrawaddy, on the road to Mandalay. I couldn't sing, I had a terrible voice, but I knew a few of the words, and I used to make that noise. And then when we got on the road, I did the same thing again. But I, so, you know, you did have a bit of fun as well. But, you know, we soon hit the other stuff. Then we came to a place where we had to dig in a bit sharp, and we found monkey nuts. We were digging monkey nuts, so we had a feed of monkey nuts. We never heard of the poisons that nuts give you then in those days, did we? I mean, even in your young days, you probably didn't know that children could die through eating nuts. You know, they can.
Through allergies.
Eh?
Through allergies.
Oh, yes, through allergies, but never heard of it in those days. But, and then, of course, our aim was Mictila, you see, which was the centre spot. And I remember on the road to Mictila, we got some reinforcements come in. We were resting up on the side of the road, and in come a few lorries with new chaps in. And the shock of their lives when they saw us. They weren't expecting anything like that. But... anyway, the battle for Mictila was quite a. We were all in that again, all of us. We were all firing at something or another. And then when it was all over in our particular part, there was a lake there, a very big lake. And of course, some of us dashed down to the water, and before we could get to the water, we could see the bullocks dead in it. So that was the water out. So then we came to a point at Mactila where there was no water. And I think it was 3 days we went without water. We filled our bottles up, and it had to be, and you weren't allowed to touch it. And I think it was 3 days before we were allowed to touch the water. And that wasn't funny, during which time we lost quite a few chaps again. I think it was the, what do they call them? I'm forgetting.
It may come back to you later anyway.
Yes, I can't. Coming down the Cabo Valley, where they'd cut the trees down, we come to a small open space, and a few hundred yards, it was a few hundred yards, probably a quarter of a mile away, a herd of elephants came out of the jungle. They come sort of roaring out, you know, out into the open. It appeared as if they sniffed around, had a look around, turned around, went back in again. And we could see from there, incidentally, we could see Kennedy Peak from down there. We were looking up at Kennedy, where we'd been the year before. There it was up there. That was quite interesting. But and then there were a lot of battles from Mactila. Each village had to be fought for. Now, on this one occasion, where I was involved to a certain extent, we were going in with tanks. We had tanks with us. And some of the lads were on the tanks, and some were walking alongside and behind the tanks. And the Japs were firing their guns at the tanks, of course. Smudge was in with his little crowd, and I was stood alongside the CO, just outside, waiting to go in. When out comes Smudge being carried out, and he was holding his stomach like this. He had a hell of a face, and he was holding his stomach like this. And I looked at him, and just as I looked at him, as he was being carried out, a figure ran across in within my sight, running like the clappers, and chaps started to shout. And I saw this bloke running, and I run, and I shouldn't have done that because I was supposed to be looking after the CO. But I ran too. You don't think about these things. I run as fast as I can. I was no runner. In school, I used to fall over if I ran fast. So I ran, and we must have run this way, like this, if you can see. We must have been running like that without realizing it.
On a converging course.
Yes, yes. Without realizing it, I was going like the clappers, and I was altering my the adjustment to my Tommy gun whilst I was going. I was going like the clappers, and he was running that way. And then he fell over, or he appeared to fall over. And I came up to him within seconds. So I stood there like a master with my gun pointing at him, and he was looking at me. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't have the heart to shoot him. And an officer came up over there, sort of in front of me, and he said, "Shoot him, Corporal." And I still couldn't shoot him. And the officer moved off and disappeared, that one. But another officer came up, and he was a tank officer. I knew he was, right, because he wore a tin hat. No soldiers wore tin hats, but he did, so he must have been a tank officer. He came up, and he stood there, and he said, "Shoot him, Corporal. Now." So I did. And that was the end of that. Now, I then went back. I hurried back. I didn't bother to look around. I knew I'd shot him. I hurried back to the CO, and I went up to where Smudge was still waiting for a little aeroplane to come in. And he'd had all his fingers blown off. When you go in like that with a rifle, like that, you see. The butt of his rifle was smashed. His fingers went with it. He didn't have any internal injury, so it turned out, but his fingers had gone. I think he had about a little finger and thumb or something on both hands, something like that. The rest of them had gone. And he had an awful face. So I felt more justified, if you know what I mean, in what I'd done. But I did have a letter, because I had a lot of letters since I wrote that book. Well, nearly everybody had bought a book wrote me a letter of some sort, but one man wrote him particularly special, and he said, "I enjoyed your book until I came to the part where you shot that prisoner." He said, "You shouldn't have done that. That was quite wrong. You ticked me off good and proper." I still think about that, but in the circumstances, I was ordered to do it. I can always put the blame on somebody else, but you cannot not do something when a major, and this second one, the first one was a captain. I know him, I can see him well. He was one of our own captains. I can see him quite well. I don't know if he's still alive or not, but I know who it is. But you can't tell them to go to hell. You just can't do that in the army. I mean, orders are orders, and that's all there is to it. But this one writer of the book ticked me off good and proper for doing that. But one wonders what he himself would have done in the circumstances. Now, whether I killed more than that, I wouldn't know, because some of the battles, of course, are sort of in between trees. You see, a chap runs from there to there, and you go brrr, or if you've got a single shotgun, you fire at him. He might fall over. You don't know who he is. You just hope he isn't one of your own sometimes. So I don't know, but that's what I do know, and I'm not too happy about it, but in the circumstances, and particularly seeing old Smudge of the state he was in, I somehow feel I justified myself there. He was a very funny man. I got a letter from him from Dulali, I think it was Dulali, which was a staging place in India. I had a letter from him later on which said he was getting on quite well, really. He said, the stubs of my fingers are wiggling in their sockets. I can always remember him saying that. I got his letter somewhere. Wiggling in their sockets. But
did you reach Rangoon? Did you get to Rangoon?
Oh yes, I got there. Not in battle, because we were held up at Pegu. The bridge that was another, the monsoons had started again. This was the
1945,
so just before the war finished. The monsoons were on again, and we used to be sopping wet, sitting about in the rain, in the pouring rain, and the bridge at Pegu collapsed. Not, it wasn't blown down. It came down with the force of the monsoons. The river rose so much it took the bridge with it, so we were stuck. The north side of the bridge, and in that was where I, the CO, and Major Broderick and myself, we went to have a look at the state of the river. And we went from where we were encamped in a jeep. Our jeep driver was called Blackett, or Blackie as we call him. Blackie was the driver, and he took us to the bridge. He parked on a hump because there was so much water around. And we decided we'd just walk up the bank of the river and have a look. Oh, it's very hot. Whew. So we all took our guns off, left them with Blackie in the jeep, all our weapons. So we walked along the bank of the river in the pouring monsoon and just carried on walking. And we're getting farther and farther away from the old jeep. And we were looking at the river just coming around this bend, terrific, terrific water in the river. And an Indian popped up from some long grass ahead of us. And he pointed over there. He said, "Japani Wala Saab." And he was pointing towards what looked like a hut of some sort. So the three of us looked at one another. We didn't have a weapon between us. But the CO said, "Oh, come on. Let's have a go." So we walked across to this Indian. We took the Indian with us.
Was he an Indian or a Burman?
Oh, no. He could have been a Burman. I can't remember. I thought he was an Indian, actually, because a lot of Indians in Burma, of course. But I thought he was an Indian, because he was a bit thinner somehow. Yeah, I think he was an Indian. But we took him with us so far, and then he stopped, of course, and we carried on. He pointed out the building. It was up on stilts. A lot of the buildings were on stilts in those areas, and a flight of rough timber steps up to the room. So we got up there quite quietly, and the CO said to Broderick, Major Broderick, he said, "We'll go in." And he looked at me and he said, "You better stay there at the bottom of the stairs in case he comes down." So I stood there, I took my cape off. You know, capes on. I took my cape off and I held it in front of me like this. A fairy queen. Held it out. And they slowly walked up the steps. And then I heard a bit of a thud. I don't know whether it was, I thought perhaps he'd knocked him out or something. But the next minute, they came out with this Jap. He wasn't a big Jap. He was smaller than me. Of course, Japanese were, a lot of Japs were very small people. And the Koreans were bigger, and a lot of Koreans, and I think it was a Korean. The one I shot was a Korean, or at least I thought he was, because he was tall. And he came down the steps, and I tied his hands behind his back, took his knives off, and I got his knife upstairs. Still upstairs there now. I keep telling my wife she should use it for Christmas to cut the turkey with, but she won't do it. It's probably the cleanest knife in the house, but she won't use it. And it's as sharp as a razor blade. It's a short one, a short knife, about that long. Yeah, with Japanese figures imprinted into the wooden scabbard. So anyway, we took him back. I gave him a cigarette, which we always did. The British troops are pretty good, really, you know. They're not all that nasty about, you know. The first thing we usually did with prisoners was give him a cigarette, which they always took. And we got him back to camp. Of course, everybody thought it was very funny. The CO and the other two getting a prisoner, which was a rare thing, you see. Getting prisoners was very rare. There weren't many prisoners taken. And the doctor took a photograph of us three, of the three of us there, but apparently they lost it or something. So it never exists. It doesn't exist now. They lost the photograph. Somebody did. But and then from there, I think we went back up the road to a place called War. W-A-W, I think it's pronounced, spelled rather. And where we were going to, cross the Sitang, which was another mighty river. And of course we didn't fancy that either, because we knew there was another Japanese army the other side. And then the bomb was dropped. And when word came that the bomb was dropped, nobody would believe it, of course. We said, "What's an?" Most chaps, I think, including myself, said, "What's an atom bomb?" Because we've never even heard of it, you know. But it gradually soaked in over a period of time that it was a real thing and that it had happened. But it was quite a few weeks before all the Japanese gave in, because they wouldn't believe it either, more so than we did. And there was a lot of... there was an awful lot of Japs killed in that period after the bomb had been dropped and before they realised that it was a fact of life, because they used to come across in droves in some places to cross the river, going east, across the Sitang, and they used to be shot by the dozen floating down the river on rafts and things. And there was an awful lot of them killed that way. And then we moved from there across the river in barges and met up with the new Japanese troops, who looked as fit as fiddles, believe me. They were good muscular legs. They weren't very tall, but by golly, they were tough looking. But they were our prisoners, and it looked a bit silly to see a skinny